Okay, good morning. The subject of today's presentation is the role of secular law in the Din Torah process. And this is an especially interesting topic from my own personal perspective because I have had the privilege of being involved both in the realm of secular law practice as well as a Beis Din halachic practice. I began my professional career as an attorney at the Wall Street law firm of Cleary Gottlieb, Steen and Hamilton, Zichronim Livracha. And after serving in the capacity of associate at that law firm for approximately 6 years, I returned to Yeshiva University, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, to complete my Yadin Yadin Smicha. Most Smicha recipients receive Yara Yara Smicha, which is the traditional smicha that trains rabbis to be proficient in laws of kashrus and orachayim, Shabbos, yontiv, normal parts of daily life. But there is an additional smicha that we offer at our yeshiva, which is yadin yadin smicha, which trains Jewish law judges to become a dayonim, to sit and adjudicate Beis Din cases, to become proficient in Jewish civil law. And the focus is not as much on the halakim of Shulchan Aruch, of Orachayim, and of Yoredeya, but much more so on Choshen Mishpat, the civil adjudication, as well as Eben HaEzer, dealing with laws of marriage and divorce. After taking a leave of absence from my law firm to complete that degree, I then had the good fortune of having done volunteer work during that period of time in the Beit Din of America, which was being really reconstituted and revitalized at that moment in history to become more responsive to commercial dispute adjudication within the Jewish community. And they were looking for people with both a halakhic background and a legal background to help out in the Beis Din. And my friend and colleague, Rabbi Michael Broyd, also a Chaver Beit Din, now at the Beit Din of America, was serving at that time as the interim director of the Beit Din. He was also a professor of law at Emory University Law School. And at the end of that year that I was doing my volunteer work at the Beit Din, Rabbi Broyd decided to return to his role as a full-time professor at Emory University Law School. And there was nobody left in the office except me, so I just changed the stationery and made myself director. And I basically became then, for the next 10 years, the director of the Beit Din of America, where I was able to utilize my legal background and the legal knowledge and merge it together with my halakhic background and halakhic knowledge in order to fuse together those two features in terms of addressing cases that came before the Beit Din. And the question of to what degree secular law has a relevance in Beit Din adjudication became really a very regular and frequent part of the decision-making process in terms of how we handle cases at the Beit Din. So first, it's important to note that the system of halakha and the system of secular law are, of course, two separate self-existing systems of law, each with their own sense of integrity. Obviously, the system of halakha is the divine system of law. From a Jewish law perspective, it is the ultimate law. It is the law to which we are all, as Jewish people, completely bound to follow in every aspect of our lives. And there, of course, can be no dilution of that law, no dilution of the Torah that can be brought about through a secular law system. Some commentators even understand that this is included within the prohibition that Rabbi Rapp just spoke about, namely, lifnei hem velo lifnei akum, that Jewish litigants are obligated to bring their disputes to a halachic court, to a Beis Din, as opposed to a secular court. So Rabbi J. David Bleich writes that included within this prohibition is that Jewish litigants are also obligated to adjudicate their cases according to Jewish law and not according to secular law. As we will see, that is not necessarily a sentiment that is universally shared, but certainly what is universally shared, and this appears in a famous responsum of the Rashba, is that it is certainly inappropriate for Jewish litigants and for a Jewish community on the whole to decide that they are going to repudiate the system of law known as the Torah, to do away with it entirely, to get rid of all of the Svarim in their bookshelves, and to replace all of those Svarim with case reporters and with legal statute treatises, and to only follow the system of law that is known as secular law. So that is the halakhic perspective from the perspective of the integrity of Torah law and the Torah system of halakha. On the flip side, in terms of secular law, at least here in this country, in America, also has its own sense of integrity vis-a-vis religious legal systems. Part of the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution stands for the proposition that courts are not supposed to become entangled in interpretations or in applications of religious law. So based, for example, on entanglement considerations, courts have generally refrained from getting involved with get decisions, from requiring husbands to give a Jewish divorce to their wives. There's a famous New Jersey decision called Aflalo, where where the court said that even though there had been certain civil courts in the United States that did decide that they're going to mandate specific performance of a get, even absence a secular contract, the New Jersey court declined to follow those precedents, feeling that this would be a violation of the separation between religion and state. There's even a rather cute case which underscores this general separation, which is called Schoenbach and Aschenhout. What happened in the Schoenbach and Aschenhout case is that the Schoenbachs, who lived in Brooklyn, heard a commotion in an adjacent apartment and discovered that the police had basically broken down the door of a neighbor's apartment because the person apparently had not been heard from in a while, and they discovered that the individual, Mr. Aschenhout, who lived there, had expired, and there was absolutely no family member who was recognized that would be able to take care of the funeral arrangements for poor Mr. Aschenhout. So the Schoenbachs took it upon themselves to perform what is in our tradition the ultimate mitzvah, right, meis mitzvah, to take care of the burial arrangements for Mr. Aschenhout. But afterwards, they discovered that poor dead Mr. Aschenhout actually had a brother who surfaced to show up basically when the burial took place. And they turned to the brother and said, well, of course, you will pay for all of the funeral expenses since you are the next of kin. And the brother said, I really appreciate that you did this wonderful mitzvah, but I'm not giving you anything. So the Schoenbachs took Mr. Aschenhout's brother, to court. And there was a court case in which they complained that here they had performed the ultimate mitzvah, and really this should have been Mr. Aschenhout's brother's responsibility, and that the court should mandate that they should be reimbursed for their expenses. And the court held that although this was a very nice deed, nonetheless, secular law does not intervene in order to reimburse people for their mitzvah performances. And the exact language of the court, which I believe is still binding precedent in the state of New York. So if anyone ever has the idea of turning to secular courts for an appreciation of their performance of chesed and mitzvah, the official court holding is, therefore, said Judge David Sachs, therefore, I hold that although the claimants performed a mitzvah, they are not entitled to recover damages. So you do not get damage recovery for the performance of mitzvah. So what I would like to focus upon for the remainder of the presentation today is the question of to what degree do we ever incorporate from the Besdin perspective considerations of secular law into our adjudication. And this is a very important issue because one of the reasons why people in the business field were not bringing cases to Besdin for adjudication, at least this was our observation, was because that there was a feeling that Besdin was not necessarily in touch with contemporary business realities, and that if Besdin would hear a case, they would adjudicate the case and decide the case according to Shulchan Aruch principles, but the business people who were involved in the transaction would have more of the expectation and even the desire that the standard principles of practice that were generally codified in secular law that they were more familiar with would be, in fact, the governing body of law to determine the outcome of any dispute that they might have. And this was a reason why they were violating the very strict halacha of going to secular court as opposed to going to Besdin, where there really is a very clear prohibition. The Ramban writes on Chumash that even if two parties agree, they make a tenai, they make a condition that they are going to waive the prohibition of going to secular court, they're still not allowed to go to secular court. So does the same idea apply with respect to applying secular law? There is a general principle in halacha that called tenai shebemamon kayim, that people can make any kind of condition regarding their monetary dealings. So that, for example, the Mishnah says that if you have somebody who is a shomer, who's a shoel, who is a borrower of an object, and normally a borrower of an object would be liable even if an accident happened to the object they were borrowing. And this borrower stipulates with the owner of the object that although that's the general rule, that's what the Torah says, nonetheless, they are going to agree that between them, this borrower is not going to be responsible should an accident occur to the object. So the Mishnah says they're allowed to make that type of stipulation. And this is the general rule. People can make stipulations in monetary law, monetary transactions, even though they're going against whatever is the default rule in halacha. So how far do we extend this? Do we extend this even so far as to say that people can stipulate that when they go in front of the Besdin, that they will be following secular law as opposed to halacha? Is that something which is permissible or is that not permissible as a matter of halacha? Going to secular court is a ritual prohibition. That's not simply a monetary prohibition. So that kind of a condition is not allowed. But what about if the condition is simply with respect to the legal system that the Besdin will invoke in terms of deciding the case? Can the parties invoke secular law as opposed to halacha? And secondly, are there cases where even if the parties don't actually make a condition that they are going to follow secular law, are there any cases where the Besdin itself incorporates into halacha the existing secular law based on principles of dina d'malchus sedina? The Gemara has a rule that's stated by the Amora named Shmuel, that we have a proposition called dina d'malchus sedina, that the law of the land is the law. So that doesn't mean that if the law of the land is that you don't have to keep Shabbos, that we no longer have to keep Shabbos. But it does mean that at least with respect to certain monetary regulations, we have respect for the law of the land. What's the primary area where we apply the principle of dina d'malchus sedina? Does anybody know? What's the main area of application? taxes, that you have to pay your taxes. Why do you have to pay your taxes? The Torah doesn't have a pasuk anywhere that says that you have to pay the government taxes. So by what authority do we have such an obligation? We have that obligation based on the principle of dina demachusa dina. So with respect to dina demachusa dina, many of the poskim struggle with defining the precise parameters of its applicability. And Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in one of his responsa, there is a tremendous confusion with respect to this issue, and it's very difficult to nail down the precise definition of when dina demachusa dina applies. However, he says, you know when it definitely applies? It applies when a government enacts a monetary regulation that has an effect on the entire society. So if you would have a subgroup within the society, say the Jewish community, that would decide that they're not going to follow this monetary regulation, it would mess everybody up. What's an example? So an example is bankruptcy law. He says if you have a regime in bankruptcy law where somebody declares bankruptcy and then the creditors don't get to collect their entire debt, but there's a certain priority of the secured creditor before the unsecured creditor and so forth. So that priority system of which creditors can collect first based on whatever percentage of the debt they're allowed to collect, that would have to be honored as a matter of halacha. Because if you had a private deal between the debtor, and let's say he had one Jewish creditor and 10 non-Jewish creditors, and he had a private deal with his Jewish creditor that he's going to pay the entire debt that he owes to that Jewish creditor, and as a result, nobody else would end up getting paid and the whole priority system would get messed up. So that would end up adversely affecting all of society and the entire regulatory system that had been set up by the government. So therefore, if a Beis Din was adjudicating a case that involved bankruptcy, then even if there was no stipulation between the parties, even if the parties both had a side agreement that they're going to violate a secular law, the Beis Din would be duty-bound as a matter of halachic principle, as a matter of dina demachusa dina, the Beis Din would be duty-bound to apply secular law, and the secular law in that case would actually not be secular law from the standpoint of halacha, but would be incorporated into the halacha based on the principle of dina demachusa dina. If you look at some of the other treatments of the subject of dina demachusa dina by other poskim, including Rav Avadya Yosef, for example, you find that probably the best articulation of the principle in terms of contemporary Beis Din adjudication is that whenever the government, whenever the system of law really cares deeply about a certain economic regulation, so that if anybody would privately contract with each other to go against that regulation, they wouldn't tolerate it. They wouldn't allow that side agreement to stand up. So whenever you have that set of circumstances, that basically triggers application of a dina demachusa dina. For example, some poskim say that this would be applicable in the domain of rent control, where if the law of rent control is that a landlord is not allowed to evict the tenant at the end of the lease term if the tenant is willing to continue to pay whatever the rent control price is for an additional term in a rent-controlled building, even though al pi halacha, once the rent term comes to an end, the landlord can say, I'm not going to continue the lease, but the rent control law says that he's obligated to continue the lease. So these poskim, including Rav Henkin, for example, say that since the government would not allow somebody, it wouldn't stand up in court if even if the landlord and the tenant agreed between themselves that the landlord would be allowed to get away with it, it wouldn't stand up in court. So therefore, when it comes to rent control law would also fall into the category of a dina demachusa dina. Or you have that with certain types of brokerage arrangements. For example, in many states, if somebody is not a licensed real estate broker and they broker a real estate deal and then they want to collect a broker fee, so it could be that both the broker and the person who contracted for the broker's services would be willing to overlook the secular law and allow for the fee to be paid. But in many states, the government would require, as a matter of law, that even if the fee was paid, the fee would have to be returned. That an unlicensed broker is not allowed to even retain the fee under those circumstances. So if there was such a case that came to Beis Din, where a party said, look, there was a contract that we both signed, and the one party said, oh, but the broker wasn't licensed, and then the Beis Din would have to examine what the local law was. And if the local law is, I believe this is the case, probably even in New Jersey, that the person is not even allowed to keep the fee, even if it would be paid, that shows that the government is makpid, that the government cares deeply about this law, even so far as not allowing it to stand. If the parties will contract around it, and therefore the Beis Din in such a case would presumably apply the principle of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. So that's in terms of the parameters of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. Most types of contracts and most types of cases don't fall into the category of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. I'll give you another example. Let's say that instead of it being a broker agreement, somebody hired a contractor to do work in their home. So a contractor, it happens, is supposed to be licensed. But let's say, and this does happen, surprisingly enough, let's say that it turns out that the contractor was not in fact licensed. And maybe the person who hired the contractor knew that the contractor wasn't licensed. And then the contractor diligently does the job. At the end of the performance of the job, at $50,000 worth of renovations. Now it's one of the most beautiful houses in Bergenfield. Now the contractor comes forward and says, I want you to pay me. And the person says, well, guess what? You're not licensed. I don't have to pay you. So if the contractor would then go to a secular court, does the contractor win or does the contractor lose? Contractor loses. The contractor doesn't get to be paid if he wasn't licensed, despite the fact that there was an agreement between the parties. But let's say that the homeowner, out of the kindness of his heart, decides that they are going to pay the contractor anyway. Would then the state step forward and say to the contractor, you better return that money, you're not entitled to keep that money? No, they're entitled to keep the money. If in fact the homeowner decides to pay the contractor anyway, they can keep the money. So we see that in this case, this is not a case where the government cares so strongly if the parties contract around the law. It's a certain protection that's built in. They're not going to force somebody to pay. But if they pay and the money was collected, that's not going to be considered to be a violation of any type of law or a statute. Therefore, in such a case, if parties contracted with each other that homeowner was going to pay the contractor, they didn't pay, and the case then came to Beis Din, and the contractor invoked the Dina D'Malchusa, the Beis Din would probably, and again, I'm not dictating the result of any specific case before the Beis Din of America in every case, I think I'm obligated to say this, Rabbi Weissman would want me to say in every case, saying L'dayan Elamashe Ein Avroos, every dayan gets to decide whatever case they're adjudicating, but it would seem, based on this general overview, that in such a case, the principle of Dina D'Malchusa Dina would most likely not be applicable. In addition to Dina D'Malchusa Dina considerations, there's also another principle in halakha that can trigger secular practices in any particular commercial industry, and that is the principle of Minag HaSochrim. What is Minag HaSochrim? Minag HaSochrim is when basically there is a practice in any particular commercial field or profession. And the halakha says that we always follow the minhag ha-sochrim. We follow the minhag ha-sochrim not only in terms of whatever happened to be the practices of a profession, but even in terms of the format of how they adjudicate disputes. We know, for example, that there's an obligation that you're not allowed to go to secular court. That doesn't mean that every single dispute has to be resolved only in Beis Din. I always tell people that there's actually no obligation in halakha to go to Beis Din, and everybody has their jaw drop. What do you mean? Here you are, a big Beis Din advocate, and you say there's no obligation to go to Beis Din. I say, that's right. If two people have a dispute, they're perfectly entitled to settle the dispute between themselves. They don't have to actually litigate it in Beis Din. Only if parties are litigating do they have to go to Beis Din. Parties can mediate, parties can negotiate between themselves. That's even something that we actually encourage from the standpoint of halacha. We encourage people to make peaceful settlements between themselves. We also would allow, in certain cases, for parties to arbitrate their disputes in front of an arbitration tribunal that was not bound by secular law. Let's say, for example, that there's an arbitration board among the American Architects Association. And that when a person enters into a contract with an architect, there's a clause that says that if we ever have a dispute, we agree that the dispute will be decided by the arbitration board of the American Architects Association. So as long as that board is not a secular court entity, and as long as that court is basically just applying not principles of law, but you have architects who are proficient in their field, and they're not judges and lawyers, but they're deciding the case according to the principles of commercial practice, that is perfectly legitimate from a halakhic standpoint. And in fact, if you go to the very beginning of the Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpat, you can see that this is not just some incredibly bold statement that I'm making to you on my own, but this is actually articulated very clearly by none other than Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Rabbi Akiva Eiger talks about a case where there were merchants from a certain industry, and one where they had a dispute. And one merchant took his partner to a Beis Din, and the other one said, I want this case removed from Beis Din and taken in front of the arbitration board of the industry. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger said that because that was the commercial practice in that industry, that any disputes were heard in front of the industry's arbitration board, the second party wins, and the case actually gets withdrawn from Beis Din. However, even if such a case is actually in Beis Din, the Beis Din certainly would be bound to apply whatever are the principles of their industry practice. So that if, for example, you have an industry where the transaction is consummated not through an elaborate written contract, but a handshake and some utterance of a mazal u'bracha or something like that, then if that is the custom of the industry, that is considered to be to create a binding transaction, then that would be respected from the standpoint of the Beis Din as well. Not only that, but there's also an understanding that if it should happen to be that the commercial practice of an industry, the way in which merchants in an industry generally expect that the disputes will be handled, and the way that they generally operate in terms of the principles of what is considered to be appropriate and to be fair and just within the industry, is consistent with principles that are articulated in secular law. So the fact that the custom of the industry happens to be consistent with what is set forth in secular law does not cause the minhag gasochrim to be any less powerful. And therefore, this is another example or manifestation of how secular law can be incorporated into the Beis Din's decision-making process. For example, let's say that the Beis Din hears a dispute regarding legal fees. If the minhag gasochrim, the standard industry practice, is that legal fees are determined in accordance with what has been or has not been articulated in the retainer agreement between the lawyer and the client, then it becomes incumbent upon the Beis Din, hearing a dispute regarding attorney's fees, to look at the language of the retainer agreement and to apply the same principles that would be applied, for example, by secular law in terms of determining what really was the agreement between the parties in terms of what would get paid and who would get paid and what amount would get paid. One of the classic examples in terms of Minhag HaSochrim that's quoted in the Sefer Piskei Choshen regards corporations. It's a big dispute whether halakha recognizes the reality of corporations, whether you can have a corporate body which is considered to be sort of a distinct entity that is not simply an amalgamation of all of the human beings who might hold stock in that company. Do we say that the corporation kind of is not a human being and it stands as its own entity? This has all kinds of ramifications in terms of corporations that hold stock in Basa V'Cholov. If a corporation holds stock in McDonald's, a corporation collects prohibited interest, a corporation owns chumitz over Pesach. It has all kinds of ramifications that impinge upon the ritual sphere. But says the Piskei Choshen, the ritual sphere is not necessarily relevant to the analysis in the monetary sphere. If a person makes a contract with a corporation and the understanding in the contract is that the corporation is going to be liable, then says the Piskei Choshen, since everybody knows that in countries, say in America, where there is corporate law and there are corporations, that the corporation has limited liability, that the corporation is treated as kind of like its own entity and is only liable in terms of the assets of the corporation. And if the corporation doesn't have assets, then the individuals who own the corporation are not personally liable. They don't have what's called shibud haguf. They don't have personal liability. So since everybody has that understanding, when they enter into a contract with the corporation from the standpoint of halacha is not going to generate greater liability and is not going to cause the individual members to be liable for any debt or obligation of the corporation, because it is presumed that it is the understanding of the parties that they are essentially entering into this transaction in accordance with the custom of the marketplace, and that is the custom of the marketplace, that there is limited liability for corporations. So that's in the realm of Minhag HaSochrim. And then the final realm, we've covered so far basically Dina D'Malchus Sedina. When does that apply? Sedina D'Malchus Sedina basically only applies to economic regulations of the state, and only economic regulations where the state would not allow it to stand if parties privately contracted around or against that particular regulation, such as bankruptcy law or according to some rent control law. Secondly, there is the application of Minhag HaSochrim, that halakha recognizes the binding nature of the customs and practices of the commercial marketplace with respect to any particular industry. And then finally, there is the third area of possible applicability, and that is going back to what we discussed earlier, namely Tanai Shibamamut, the case where the parties, they're not necessarily commercial merchants, they're just parties to a case, to a dispute, who have stipulated that they want secular law to govern their dispute. Is this something which is recognized or not according to halacha? This is very relevant, for example, to the Beit Din of America prenuptial agreement. The Beit Din of America prenuptial agreement is intended to, number one, prevent aguna situations, but also encourage parties to resolve all aspects of any divorce dispute should one arise within the arena of the Beit Din of America as opposed to secular courts. Because just like any other commercial dispute between two Jews is not allowed according to halacha to be adjudicated in secular court, the same applies to divorce disputes. A couple that unfortunately needs to get a divorce is allowed to pick up the divorce decree from a civil court, because a Beis Din can give a get, but doesn't have the ability to give a civil judgment of a divorce. But nonetheless, with respect to any monetary disputes that need to be adjudicated, such as division of assets or payment of spousal support or child support and so forth, all of that, according to halacha, if it needs to be litigated, has to be litigated in a Beis Din as opposed to secular court. So at one point, the great rabbinic sage in Eretz Yisrael, who used to sit on the Beis Din HaGadol, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, turned to the Beis Din of America and suggested that in order to encourage parties to have more of a comfort level, both men and women, to have more of a comfort level in terms of adjudicating disputes in the Beis Din as opposed to civil court, that we have in our prenuptial agreement an option the parties can choose, where they can choose that instead of the Beis Din deciding the monetary aspects of the divorce in accordance with strict halakha, which most people are not so familiar with and wouldn't necessarily want to govern the financial aspects of their marriage. Most people are not thinking in terms of Nichsei Melug and Nichsei Tzon Barzel and these other halakhic constructs when they think of their monetary rights in marriage. Many of the women might not want to get married. Who knows? But when it comes to equitable distribution law, community property law, so that is something that is more familiar with the couples who marry in large segments within our community. So therefore, he suggested you have a clause that says that the parties want the Beis Din to adjudicate any end of marriage issues in accordance with equitable distribution law. And the Beis Din, in fact, inserted such a clause. Now, there were some other rabbinic scholars who criticized this and said, how can you explicitly choose to have secular law govern a dispute that is being heard by a Beis Din? And Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg responded to these criticisms. Much of this is published in one of the issues of the Yeshurun Journal, this correspondence. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg responded saying that private parties have the right to make any kind of contractual arrangement when it comes to monetary law that they wish. That's the principle of Tanai Shibim Mamon Kayim. And even though the Rashba had said that one is not allowed to repudiate the system of halacha, and in fact this was one of the criticisms that the Chazon Ish had of the establishment of the civil court system in the state of Israel, even though all the judges were Jewish, he said nonetheless that's a violation because they are repudiating Torah law. Here, said Rav Zalman Nechemya, this is not a wholesale repudiation of Torah law or even any aspect of Torah law. It's a private agreement between two parties as to how they intend to conduct themselves when it comes to the monetary affairs of their marriage. And therefore, it's a classic Tanai Shebe Mamon. It's a classic monetary condition, which is, in fact, allowed. And that is the general position which is taken by the Beis Din. If you look at the Beis Din of America's rules and procedures, I believe it's section 3. This is spelled out in a greater length in perfect lawyerly language, which basically says that the Beis Din of America will respect all choice of law provisions that are entered into between the parties to the fullest extent permitted according to Jewish law. It's a great line. Gives the dayanim the latitude that's needed in case the parties should, for example, make a condition which would be in violation of Jewish ritual law. Like, for example, that they charge prohibited interest, even if both parties agree. We all know that that is still a Torah prohibition. But when it comes to something like how assets at the conclusion of a marriage are going to be disposed and divided, so then that is a perfectly acceptable and permissible area for such a contractual clause to be formulated. Furthermore, Rav Moshe Feinstein goes even one step further, and Rav Moshe writes that, let's say you have a case where the parties did not explicitly contract that they wanted principles of secular law to govern their transaction, but based on their history of dealing, or based on the context of the transaction, it's quite clear that that was the implicit understanding between the parties. So if Moshe writes that even if it's simply an implicit understanding, let's say there was no explicit clause that was signed by the parties, there was no explicit contract that was signed before the Beis Din, but it's quite clear to the Beis Din that this was the intention of the parties, so then halacha also allows us to impute a tonight, to say that there is an implied condition between the parties. So in that sense, an implied condition can be applicable even in the realm of a secular law, just like there could be an implied condition that two merchants intended to conduct themselves according to the customs of the marketplace, there can be an implied condition that a husband and wife intended that their assets be disposed of a certain way, and there could be indications of how they manifested that intention in terms of how they registered their assets and so forth. And a Beis Din can take all of that into consideration as well in determining the outcome of the case. So in conclusion, in terms of just the summary of areas where secular law can be applicable, basically they can be applicable from the standpoint of the Beis Din, either in limited circumstances of Dina de Malchus Adina, such as bankruptcy law. They can be applicable when there is a commercial dispute and there is a custom of the commercial marketplace that's consistent with secular law. That's what we would call minaga sochrim. And they can be applicable when you have a tanai shebimamon, when you have either an explicit or implicit condition between the parties that they wanted basically secular principles of monetary law to govern their transaction. It still is absolutely imperative in every single case that the dispute be adjudicated in a Beis Din as opposed to a civil court, even if there are principles of monetary law that are relevant to the adjudication of the dispute, because the requirement of a Beis Din is not simply a monetary obligation, but that is a ritual obligation, and that cannot be bypassed by the parties. And in addition, the Beis Din has to take into account a full-fledged analysis of to what degree the secular principles are applicable or are not applicable. And there may be cases where the secular law principles will be applicable in part, but will not be applicable in other part. And all of that is part of the Beis Din adjudication process. Ultimately, the ability of the Beis Din to take these considerations into account and to incorporate a sensitivity towards the expectations of the parties and the general course of their business dealing is part of what raises the luster of the Beis Din, is part of what enables us to fulfill the mitzvah of tzedek tirdof, of pursuing righteousness through, as the Gemara says, Holech achar Beis Din Yafeh, that you should go after a Beis Din Yafeh, not just any Beis Din, but you should have a Beis Din which is competent, you should have a Beis Din which is proficient in terms of the needs of the modern day community, and this is a function that we hope that we are fulfilling to the best of our ability at the Beis Din of America. Thank you very much.